Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we talk with returning guest Dr. Carmen Bolter about her documentary project, The New Atlantis. But first, we look at a story in other news about the effort to expand water fluoridation in New York State. We're joined now by Carol Koff, the media director for the New York State Coalition Opposing Water Fluoridation. Carol, welcome to another news.
Thank you.
Well, this report came out a few days ago looking at the New York State getting ready to expand fluoridation and,
yes,
and a budget for that as well. Can you tell listeners what's going on here?
Okay, well, first of all, fluoride chemicals are added to public water supplies to attempt to reduce tooth decay in people who drink tap water. It's not added to purify the water. It doesn't have to go in there. And the fluoridation chemicals that are used are not natural. They're waste products of the phosphate fertilizer industry, which contains lead, arsenic, and other chemicals at trace levels, but we shouldn't be adding that to the water. What's happening now is we have the New York State Department of Health ignoring all this evidence and wanting to expand fluoridation throughout New York State. Currently, actually, New York City is fluoridated, but we had a great city councilor last year, Peter Vallone, try in vain to reverse that. He had about 7 co-sponsors, but never made it out of the health committee. It's a very political issue. And there's no doubt that fluoride is not safe to be ingested. It's ineffective, and it's a waste of money, but it's a political issue.
Carol, can I stop you there for a minute?
Sure.
Why is it such a political issue to remove the water fluoridation process in New York City drinking water?
Because as soon as anyone raises any concern about it, they'll get flooded with letters and phone calls and lobbyists, mostly organized dentistry, who have a vested interest in protecting fluoridation because it's linked to their political viability. Organized dentistry is made very rich by corporations that benefit from tooth decay, so they're not a disinterested party. You'll have health departments urged to write letters. This is their job. Their job is to sell us fluoridation. If they ever didn't, they would be out of a job. They're not there to evaluate it. They're there to promote it. The other thing, so the political, because who has the money? We don't. We work on a shoestring. But, you know, when you need endorsements, you'll go, or political funds, you'll go to organized dentistry, American Dental Association, New York State Dental Association, New York City, and I think each borough may have one. American Dental Association, one of the most politically active and politically rich health PACs in the country. They get, by having so much money, they can get laws passed that benefit themselves. So we've had situations where a legislator has come out against fluoridation and the pro-fluoride people will gather all their money and friends and influence and get the guy kicked out. So there's a lot of powerful stuff going on behind the scenes that I can't put my finger on. We're still waiting for that wonderful investigative reporter to expose it. But it's happening little by little. We just said that actually the country of Israel just banned fluoridation based on the health effects. We've had many cities in New York State that have rejected fluoridation, including Albany. And
right.
Nassau, Suffolk, Rockland County does not fluoridate, and we have a lower tooth decay rate than New York City. You'll also get editorials that'll vilify anyone opposed to fluoridation. If you're a politician, that's the last thing you want.
That's true. I noticed that the Village Voice actually was making fun of the effort to ban fluoridation in New York City.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you something. I went to school at NYU, and one of the first things they advised me to do, because I was basically trying to get information on fluoridation, couldn't understand why. I thought they didn't understand science until I realized the politics behind it. I actually, my professor encouraged me to call the Village Voice because they're so progressive. And I was shocked they wouldn't accept an article from me because they said I was too biased. But the Village Voice is a biased paper. So, yeah, unfortunately, it's usually the more liberal, democratic people who think fluoridation is good because they think it's helping poor people, but it isn't. It's harming them even more. Fluoride is a chemical that hurts your body, and if you're not properly nourished, it does even more harm. For example, low-income children have much more tooth decay, and they have more fluorosis also, which is the outward sign of fluoride toxicity.
We've heard, certainly by your reports from the coalition in New York State to oppose water fluoridation, that it's costing $24 million annually.
Yes.
However, there is a $5 million budget allotted now. Is that an increase to the $24
million? No, what it is that we have a Freedom of Information request several years ago to New York City specifically to list all the what fluoridation costs, chemicals, manpower, et cetera, et cetera. And it came to $24 million. That's just in New York City. New York City is spending like $24 million every year.
Okay.
That's the rest of the state is also spending money. The $5 million is in Governor Cuomo's budget. It was reported only in Newsday. It's the only place I saw it. And they said he was allotting $5 million for fluoridation, which we don't like at all because we don't want to see it expanded, especially those on Long Island, because we don't have fluoridation. So we don't want him using that money to force it upon us.
Now I understand. I got it. Okay.
Yeah. It's really, really important if people can't do anything else to just write one email to their city council or the mayor, any elected official, and tell them, please stop fluoridation. You don't have to write a lot. You could just say you don't want it. And if you're really ambitious, send that, you know, on Twitter and Facebook and anything else and tell your friends and neighbors to do the same thing.
Carol Kopp, the media director with the New York State Coalition Opposing Water Fluoridation, thank you very much for being on In Other News.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Dr. Bolter is the director, producer, and writer of the powerful documentary series called The Pyramid Code. The series has aired in more than 30 countries, and there are many breakthrough discoveries in it, such as how the Great Pyramid served as an energy generator. It was built on intersecting ley lines and constructed with specific materials that are now thought to have harnessed and stored power. The power was created by the interaction of sunlight on water, moving through passageways to build a charge using large crystals. This concept is similar to Nikola Tesla's design at the Wardenclyffe Tower. Dr. Bolter, a former professor at the University of Calgary, is also producing another documentary series titled The New Atlantis. There have been advances in her current research, as well as setbacks. We talk about that and the emerging field of space archaeology, and also the ancient unified writing found all over the world. Dr. Bolter is the author of the book Angels and Archetypes, an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness. Her website is pyramidcode.com. Dr. Bolter, welcome back to In Other News.
Thanks for having me.
It's important to reiterate the context here because of the vast pool of disinformation out there. Could you remind listeners about the Pyramid Code documentary series that you wrote, produced, and directed?
Yeah, the Pyramid Code is a 5-episode documentary series, and basically it's tackling the misinformation of what we're told in school about Egypt. So pretty much we get told that the pyramids were built by slaves for the eagles of pharaohs, and that they were tombs, and that the Egyptians were obsessed with death, and they worshipped animals. And none of that's true at all. And so I go through the series debunking all of these different storylines that we've been given, and it doesn't seem to stop them that they've never found a mummy inside a pyramid to keep saying that the pyramids are tombs. The straight-sided pyramids are absolutely not. They're energy devices. There's lots of scientific information that shows that. So there's a whole episode on high-level technology. But also the pyramid fields themselves. Like, what do they represent, and why are the pyramids scattered the way they are? So we visit 6 pyramid sites during the series and look at the technology around them. And then there's one called The Empowered Human, and that is the whole storyline on, you know, what did the Egyptians know? And it seems that they were focused on cosmology and biology. So in essence, the simplest way to put it is that they were interested in what happens before we come here, how we get here, and what happens when we leave. And they actually did not have a word for death. So laced through the series is an indigenous wisdom keeper's information called Hakim. And he learned a lot from oral tradition, from his ancestors, things that weren't written down. And so he has a lot of key points. But what I did was I knew that Hakim was going to pass away because he's a pretty old man. And so I decided I was going to find scientists that corroborated what he said. So he doesn't work to try to prove or explain how he knows what he knows. And so I found a number of scientists that were able to explain some of the things he said. And then he also says it so it's easier for the listener. And so it was an ambitious project, and I paid for it all myself. And what I learned is that the media is not really interested in anything that's finished. So they give you like pennies on the dollar. So it's still aired in 38 countries, but I didn't even make 20% of what I spent on it back. And that's interesting because the media wants to be able to have their hand in a project. They want to be able to put their messages in, and they're not that focused on the truth. So I feel really fortunate that I was able to make the series, that I was able to get the information out of Egypt and the footage. And so it's really an anomaly in that you're not going to find too many documentary series like it.
No, you're not. And I highly recommend this to listeners. As a result of producing this series, were you then looking at other ancient cultures around the world and seeing parallels?
Well, absolutely. And the thing is that more information is coming up all the time. And so since I made the Pyramid Code, there's been discoveries of real-life straight-sided pyramids in a number of different countries. Bosnia, Serbia, Indonesia, Antarctica, South Africa, Alaska, in a number of different places. And then there's all the structures that are underwater, because we're talking a whole different age here. These pyramids were all built way before they tell us. And that's another thing that I do in the Pyramid Code is I look at a different timeline that expands in 26,000-year cycles that allows us to get a picture of what the ancients were doing. So these new pyramids that are being found, a lot of them are covered in about 3 or 4 feet of soil, and then they've got trees growing on the top. And there's pyramids in China as well that they actually planted trees on because they're trying to hide them. But that indicates that those pyramids are pre-diluvian, before the flood. And then the silt, as the water receded, would have left this soil that was fertile on the pyramids that then were able to grow trees over the top. So most people, you know, don't even recognize that there's a pyramid underneath some of these treed areas because the trees aren't all the same height, so it's hard to perceive that there'd be something that was straight-sided.
Your new series that you're working on is titled The New Atlantis, and why the New Atlantis, Carmen?
Well, there's lots of information about what the Atlanteans did and the knowledge that they had before the continent sank. And that knowledge has been harnessed by scientists, some choice people, who are now building a new complex of pyramids in Russia. And so the series takes us to the actual ancient texts that give us the prophecy of what was happening in Atlantis and take it all the way into the future of what's being done now, what's already been done, and what's planned for the future. So it's quite an interesting situation that we've got because we can benefit from the information that the Atlanteans had.
The government of Russia seems to have a different take on microwave radiation and its harmful effects on human beings, such as banning the use of microwave ovens. There are other examples as well. What's going on there?
Well, first of all, there was all kinds of scientific procedures and discoveries that were made behind the Iron Curtain when Russia was still the Soviet Union. And so they've understood the dangers of microwave radiation and even Wi-Fi and that sort of thing. And so they've banned the use of microwave ovens, and people here think, oh, they'll catch up to us soon, and they just don't have that technology yet. But it's the opposite, that they've had it, and they've understood that it's dangerous. And so what it does is it blocks the connection of human beings to the telluric currents, which are what are in the ley lines that are running along the Earth. And it's very, very disruptive to human beings. Now, they have a completely different agenda there, and I think it's fascinating that Americans and the news media is demonizing everything that's going on in Russia. you know, thinking about the KGB and all of that. And when I was there, I was just so impressed with how sophisticated everything was, and the architecture and fashion, and people were so, you know, calm and self-contained and multilingual and well-educated. And it was just an incredibly artistic vibration of intellect. And so let me tell you that this pyramid that they built was actually put there, the first one in a cluster that's going to have 9 pyramids. And it was funded by a produce company because they wanted a place to store vegetables before they went on the trucks to be delivered to people that would energize the food. And so when they were looking for a model of how to do that, they realized that a pyramid structure was going to be the best thing that would energize the food. So they have no GMOs. They're completely outlawed there. And so our food system here is toxic, completely toxic. Like, that's why so many people are into gluten-free, because the wheat has been tampered with to the point where it's literally poisonous. And so for us, they spray Roundup glyphosate all over the field, and then they plant the wheat, and it grows up through the poison. And so in Russia, they're not doing any of that, and they really are thinking in terms of how can they help people become more conscious and more healthy. And that's for real. Like, we don't even believe it, because we don't have any of that. We've got, you know, it seems like everything that's around us is designed to hurt us. And so even with Wi-Fi, they chose the band, the number of hertz, to replicate the human body. So it's actually breaking people's bodies down. And most people aren't sensitive enough to realize that, and it takes a good long time before the body will start to really be affected and compromised by it. And I'm one of those people that suffered from radiation poisoning because I took so many flights and I got, you know, zapped in the security lines. And, you know, when you're in a plane, it's like getting an X-ray every 9 minutes. And Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and all those kinds of devices are actually damaging the body on a lot of different levels. And there's not terribly much being said about that.
No, there isn't. It's really interesting how Russia is extremely mindful about microwave radiation, while the United States and North America were practically bathed in this RF frequency constantly, with the Gwen towers and the so-called cell phone towers that have cropped up everywhere within our landscape. And it is doing a lot of harm. Somebody recently said, here in the United States, we're living in an electromagnetic prison. Now, isn't there some significance to the location of those pyramids that are being built in Russia?
Yeah, absolutely. There, and again, we have all these associations with all things Russian. So it's in Siberia, and, you know, that's where we think of people going into exile. But that's not true anymore at all. You know, every place has its history. But it's right in the center of the landmass. Russia is a very, very large country. And so if you divide it east, west, and north, south, the location of the pyramids smack in the middle. And that's true for Giza as well. It's the largest, you know, the width of the African continent. So it's right in the center of the largest landmass as well, too, there, that in that continent. Mm. And so it's right in the center of Siberia. And the model is to put 4 pyramids, or the central one's there. You can even see it on Google Earth. You know, got the casing stones made out of crushed quartz polymer. And the idea was to follow what Plato had said about a circle of canals, a circle around a central pyramid, and 4 pyramids north, south, east, west, and then another circle around with 4 more pyramids. So the 8 more pyramids are being built, and the first one's done. And then in the land around it, they have different domains and research facilities for 12 different domains. So transportation, health, education, communication, technology, agriculture, horticulture, all those different things. And they even have an orphanage there, taking in people who, you know, don't have anywhere to be. And so this is all highly sophisticated and bringing in the whole idea of free energy and a new paradigm in education and true health built on prevention instead of the medical model. And that's what they're doing there.
Have you checked back with them since you visited?
Oh, I talked to, I don't have details in the last year. I mean, I chit-chatted with them, but I didn't get an update. So I'm not sure what's going on right now. But that will be part of the new series that we'll actually go and we'll interview the people that are responsible for each of the domains.
Now, this is an interesting area because you've been experimenting with the gas discharge visualization camera that Dr. Konstantin Korotkov had devised and helped build. And you used it to measure the subtle energy fields around people before and after entering certain chambers inside a pyramid. Can you remind us about that and how that's going to be put into the New Atlantis series?
Okay, so it's a form of electrophotonic imaging, and it is a higher resolution version of Kerbalian photography. And so what it's doing is it's measuring the photonic emissions that come off the human body. And there's a way through the program that calculates logarithms to trace back to the meridians in the body and to the chakra system. And that's more like the glands of the human body. And so what I did was I replicated this study a second time because I wanted to see what the differences would be. So I did it in 2010. And then again, I replicated the exact study in 2012 with a different group of people. So I have some 500 readings, actually. So what I did was I took a baseline of everybody and measured people before they were close to the sacred structure. And then everyone went into the Great Pyramid, and they took 2 minutes inside the sarcophagus in the so-called King's Chamber with the proper orientation so that their pineal gland would actually be located right where the focus of the energy from the way the pyramid was designed was. And this is where high-level initiates practiced doing out-of-body experiences because they wanted to be able to be conscious as they passed to the other side. And so they would actually practice that there. And so the subjects that I was measuring went into the Great Pyramid, into the sarcophagus for 2 minutes. And then when they came out, we actually had the GDV in the chamber and we measured them. And then we took their measurements later away back at the hotel and saw how the energy was integrating. And in the second study, I added a delayed post-test. So 3 days later, we measured them again to see how things had changed. But then, because the sample was big enough, there was enough people, I was able to use statistical data analysis to see what the correlations were and how it's affecting the human aura. So the title of the paper is The Effect of the Great Pyramid on the Human Aura and the Chakra System, because those are the measures that are actually possible with the GDV. And I was actually, my hypothesis was, is it possible to become more psychic, and what would it mean? Like, how could you measure psychicness? And so when you think about somebody, you know, having a deep knowing, you'll say something like the hair on their arms stands up, or they get this shiver through them. But it's actually a connection of the different chakras, if you will. So when you can connect your communication center with your throat chakra and your third eye, for example, that assists in becoming more psychic. And I've got all the literature review that substantiates that. So what was happening is the chakras were becoming entrained. And so there was a strong correlation between the energy in the pyramid that was supporting people becoming more connected. So before they went in, they weren't connected. And when they came out, they were. So that's a simplistic way of saying it, but it's pretty fascinating stuff, for sure. And the difference between the 2012 and the 2010, to me, showed a general evolution in terms of consciousness. It's a way to measure consciousness fields. And so, you know, again, comes out of Russia. We don't have anything like that here.
Dr. Poulter, what do you think the importance was of the ancient initiates to be conscious before dying? Why do you think they wanted that?
Oh, to me, it's normal. They didn't have a word for death. Now, we're all mixed up with death because I think it roots back to Emperor Constantine in 323 AD outlawing reincarnation. And so we have this very distorted sense of what it means to live and that dying means that's it. And so that's why TV seems to have, you know, such a focus on death, 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 blood from death instead of blood from life. The idea that we are having an experience on Earth, but we're really spiritual beings, is probably more accurate than we come here once and then it's over. And so that's interesting that, you know, in school we're taught that the Egyptians were obsessed with death, but they knew we lived on. And so the thing is that how do you move through the different levels of, again, the levels of awareness that let your physical body pass and your consciousness continues? The thing is that they had to learn how to do that, so they did out-of-body experiences. But also, the high-level initiates seem to be able to you know, work with anti-gravity and work with bilocation and teleportation. So when we do the Beam Me Up Scotty and look at that on Star Trek, we think of that as fiction, but it's actually probably more science. And again, over the years, there have been a lot more studies done on that sort of thing. And so it really is a measure of consciousness. And that, I think, needs to be the highest value. In the summary at the end of the Pyramid Code, it's like, how would our world change if consciousness was the highest value instead of profit? So that's what the Egyptians were all about.
This material that you're speaking about will be part of the project that you're working on titled The New Atlantis. And you had pitched this to Canadian networks last year. Could you tell listeners about that experience?
Okay, my agent in New York said the problem with the Pyramid Code is that it's finished, and networks like to be involved in shows. And so if you ever have a project that isn't finished, call me and we'll see what we can do and get some networks involved. So I was originally supposed to get funding through Russia, and that fell through, and so I called up my agent and told him, and he said, okay, I'm going to get on this, and he found award-winning director out of Edmonton and an award-winning producer out of Toronto. And the four of us had conference calls every week for 6 months. And, you know, they kept saying, we'll rewrite it this way and rewrite it that way, and it should be four episodes. No, it should be two. No, it should be six. And it was all over the place. And so I kept rewriting the script and, you know, having the through line through the story, and they led me to believe that the last iteration that I had formatted, and they wanted, you know, one page as a beginning introduction and one page per episode and the cast of characters, and I formatted it all and illustrated it all and sent it off to them. And next thing I knew, the director had read two books on Atlantis, and he was, you know, putting Atlantis in Alberta and had Foam Woman in the Pacific Ocean, and he castrated Quetzalcoatl and all over the place, completely fictitious story, renamed it to The Watchers. There was absolutely not a word of it that resembled anything that I had written. And there was no formatting on it. You know, it was 17 pages long instead of one page per episode. Now it's three episodes instead of four. And they sent that to the networks, and it was called The Watchers. And my name was on it. And then they wanted me to illustrate it before they sent it. But there was nothing real anymore. So every single thing that I was talking about, you know, stone spheres, elongated skulls, all those things had pictures. Pyramids all over the world. And they didn't even understand that the story was about pyramids. So in other words, if networks get their hand on something, they want it to be fictitious, sensationalized, and completely made up, but also authoritative. This is, it's this, it's this. You know, not hedging and saying, you know, from the evidence we have, it could be or it looks like. I mean, I felt ideologically assaulted by the whole thing because it was hard for me to believe that they had no link to the truth at all.
Well, now you're in a situation where you are continuing to produce this documentary series. However, you're doing it in an independent way. Can you tell listeners about this process?
Well, I've decided that, you know, I got some 14,000 letters from people after I did the Pyramid Code because everybody was just so pleased that it resonated in a way that they felt good about. Like they didn't, like other documentaries just didn't resonate as true as this one. And so they felt compelled to find me and tell me that. And so I know, and many, many people were saying, okay, let's have more of that. I really do have more material, and so I've decided the only way to go is independently and to ask people for help to, you know, buy the series and first and then, you know, give me the money right away so that I can use that to finish the series. So I'm going with a crowdfunding campaign, and I'm going to ask people to support it. So if people want to support it with a little bit more than that, they can have their name in the credits or become an executive producer and be part of history in the making. So there's some original archaeological digs that are going to be part of the series, and people can get reports on what's going on with that. And so I'm going to ask people to help.
Great idea. This is very exciting. So it's a crowdfunding campaign, and people can be involved who do help to support your project. Where do they go? How do they find out about this?
Pyramidcode.com. The information will be there. The campaign will launch in a few days. It all has to be verified by the crowdfunding website, Indiegogo. And so they can just go to my website, and that'll direct them straight to the little video that goes with it and to the campaign itself.
Our guest is Dr. Carmen Bolter. We're talking about her current project called The New Atlantis. We'll be right back after this break.
So you're free. So happy birthday.
Dr. Bolter is our guest. We're talking about her project, The New Atlantis. Dr. Bolter, can you talk about the Giza Plateau being a unified field and what convinces you that there were structures there before the Great Pyramids?
Well, you can see, actually, the shape around the Second Pyramid is actually much larger and a different, it's not square like the Second Pyramid, so there definitely were other structures there. But the actual location of the key pyramids are connected to a star system, and Robert Bovall gave us this with Orion. But I talk about the Band of Peace in the Pyramid Code, and there's actually six pyramid sites, and I've made quite an important discovery through connecting with Starry Night Pro, which is it's the Google Earth of the sky, and you can run the program back 50,000 years and forward 50,000 years and see where the star systems align, and this particular system along the extragalactic grid has Sirius at the top point, but it actually shows that the Sun and Sirius are in a binary system. And Walter Cruttendon brought us that through mythology, that the Sun and Sirius could be in a binary system, but he was looking at all the legends where people were talking about that. And so I plotted that and Cygnus for Deshur, and kept going, and if you keep going, you come right to the galactic center, and you come back around on the extragalactic grid, and it's back to Sirius. And so I plotted a number of different star systems, and if they weren't correct, they blew apart, and they didn't stay in the alignment. And when I found the correct ones, I was actually able to run it back 50,000 years and forward 13,000, and it never fell apart. And so I'm still missing one of the systems, which is connected to Saqqara. I've tried like 25 different star systems, and it doesn't fit. So that sounds a little complicated, and there'll be an animation in the new series. But it's really showing that the ancients understood our place outside the galaxy and how that worked. And they were looking to ground these star systems in the sky-ground correlation by representing them on Earth with pyramids. So, you know, they're far more sophisticated than we've ever given them credit for. And so I find this incredibly exciting and relevant because the alignment, the Sun was exactly aligned with the galactic center at sunset, Giza, December 21st, 2012. And that was heralded as being highly significant. And then, of course, the media got a hold of it and said it was Armageddon and zombie apocalypse is coming. And, of course, that's not what it is at all.
This suggests that there were spacecraft possibly being used by this civilization to be able to have that kind of perspective out there in the galaxy. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've come to think that, you know, we get so obsessed with spaceships and the idea that, you know, we're all driving around in little vehicles in our cars, and so we imagine that extraterrestrials are running around in their vehicles. But I think that they were able to shapeshift and come into human bodies and, you know, even be disincarnate and also show up in certain ways. And so the connection that the ancient Egyptians had with other beings, with ancestors, with wise ones that were disincarnate was kind of a normal thing. And so I'm not so sure that they necessarily, you know, showed up in spaceships, so some of them may have. But Hakim, you know, a lot of people, like, you know, want to think that the extraterrestrials built the pyramids. But in my mind, being a university professor, that's not verifiable. You know, it's not that I'm not open to psychic elements, obviously, but I want to ground that in some kind of reality. So I can't prove that in any way, that the extraterrestrials built the pyramids. But also, Hakim was adamant that it wasn't necessary because the ancient initiates were so powerful and developed in themselves. So he claims they had 360 senses, which makes sense, and they had abilities, and the abilities had to do with the transmutation of the atom. And so when you think about pyramids around the world, the ones that are workable, working machines, if you will, technology devices, if you will, all had to do with water being beneath the pyramid and a network of passageways in a zigzag form that was generating energy. But if you even look at Chris Dunn's work in the Great Pyramid about the blowing the oxygen and the hydrogen molecule of the water apart, it's actually transmutation of the atom, building a charge. And it has to do with quartz crystal under pressure and the stone that these pyramids are built out of, and the combination of different stones is highly relevant in terms of it being like an insulated wire. And actually, it was about blowing the water molecule apart, but in an implosion sense, not an explosion sense, so it was non-polluting. So it was a completely different Stone Age type of technology. But within the human body, we're largely built of water. Some people say up to 70% water. So the transmutation of the atom within the body actually contributed to these abilities. So, and this is recorded even in ancient Indian texts. So telepathy, manifestation, alchemy, bilocation, anti-gravity, and teleportation were all part of the abilities that came once the high-level initiate was operating at a certain level. Then they were able to do all this. And so anti-gravity is an obvious one that would allow real humans with the DNA that we have now to be able to lift these huge stones. And there's one stone on the Giza Plateau that's 200 tons. Well, if you think about a light rapid rail car, that's 9 tons. And if you can only imagine, you know, a small group of us trying to put, you know, a rail car every minute up onto the roof of my house, and another and another and another, you know, that we can't conceive of how they built those pyramids, because we're not operating with a full deck, if you will, and all of the senses that they were able to work with. And so we're at a state right now where we're quite densified, and the ancient Egyptians had much more refinement. And I think we've tumbled through golden ages and then dark ages, and we're at the bottom of a dark age right now. And that's why it's really difficult for us to understand what they were doing and how they did it.
Yeah, this area is very important. There's a lot of work to keep it hidden right now, and you've come across that experience as well. There's so much destruction of archaeological evidence, not only in Egypt, but in other places such as South America. Can you tell listeners about what you've found out about that?
Well, the propensity is to tell us that we're 6,000 years old. And so when out-of-place artifacts are found, archaeologists aren't allowed to tell a new story. So they have to toe the party line, and everything's supposed to be 6,000 years old. So I've met with people who have taken samples to thermoluminescent labs, and they estimated that the sample would have been something in the area of 1 million years old. And the lab kept it for a year, and then came back to them and said, well, we're not going to charge you for it, and it's 5,800 years old. And so what almost certainly happened is the lab analysis found that the thing was a lot older, and the people running the lab said, you can't tell them. So just give it back and give them a year, and it's under 6,000 years old. I mean, it's hard to believe that, you know, we can't even use science properly, but that tends to be what happens. Now, things like carbon-14 dating are notoriously wrong. The date, and there was a scientist conference when I actually met Zachariah Sitchin in Portland, Oregon in 96, where the scientists got together and did a roundtable discussion, and they were discussing dating techniques. And I had the privilege of sitting in. They invited me to come and sit in with them. Mm-hmm. And someone was giving, they wanted to see if carbon-14 was accurate or not. And so they took one sample and divided it into 11 pieces and sent it to 11 labs. And it came back with 11 dates. Every single date was different of the same sample. Well, you can't tell me that's accurate. But the other thing is that carbon-14 completely breaks down at about 30,000 years. But if we were to analyze, it's measuring organic material. And a lot of times, like stone, you can't date stone with carbon-14, so that makes it not very useful. If we found a campfire that was 100 years old, it would be 100 years plus or minus 5. With carbon-14, but if it's 30,000, it's plus or minus 3,000 or something. You know, it's like it's just completely, it starts to break apart. But nevertheless, you have to make sure you don't contaminate the sample, and it's really easy to have a fleck of your skin drop into it, or if they put it in a plastic bag and it sweats, then the spores of mold can be end up mixing up the date. And so there's all kinds of things that make it not the best technique. And so there are potassium argon techniques, there's, you know, photoluminescent, there's other techniques that can be used. But it's very, very expensive, and it's not as common as carbon-14 dating, so there aren't as many labs, and, you know, we don't know who's actually running the labs and that sort of thing. So it's really problematic. So part of the, you know, the pure archaeology ends up being, where's your lab and where are you going to get that thing dated if you possibly can get your hands on something that's new that hasn't been dated? So these are the things that we deal with in the field. But the knowledge is getting stronger, and there are people who are careful to find the right kinds of dating, and there's new archaeological digs that are actually showing things are much, much older than we ever imagined. And so Michael Cremo is one that he wrote Forbidden Archaeology, and I'm actually speaking with him both in Vancouver and Victoria, I'm very excited, at the Modern Knowledge Tour August 29th and 30th this year. And Klaus Donna is another one, and he specializes in out-of-place artifacts. And so people contact him, because if you were to find something in Peru in your backyard digging a well, an item of gold, the government would come, put you in jail, take the item, and tell everybody you stole it. Take your property, too. And in Egypt as well, in the Valley of the Kings, if somebody was digging a well and they found a gold statue or whatever, the government would come and put them in jail and take the artifact, take their house. And so, you know, people are scared when they find something, but they still, you know, if you found an original gold artifact, you should think, well, what am I going to do with it? I got to give it to somebody, or at least find out, you know, what it is. And so Klaus Donna has been someone that, you know, many people have contacted with these out-of-place artifacts. And he's actually doing a big show in 2016 in Vienna, bringing a lot of these artifacts back together. And so, you know, he has occasion to find things that are very old indeed. And so the story is starting to change, but it seems to be not connected to the mainstream, and certainly not connected to the media. And that's the case with the Bosnian pyramids as well. So Dr. Sam Osmanagic has been given the rights to all of the science that's going on and the excavations going on at the Bosnian pyramids. But the media has put a silence on it. So he's doing all kinds of incredible work. It may be the most active and productive archaeological site on the planet at the moment. It's incredible. And every year they do a hidden mysteries conference, and I've spoken at that. So they found some organic material, and they sent it through Klaus Donna and sent it to a dating lab. And they came up with a date that is really quite astonishing. And again, I say it still could be older than that. But the date that they came up with through carbon-14 is 38,000 years.
And that has a plus or minus of a large number of years.
That's correct. And I would say it's older, for sure it's older. Everything seems to be older than we can tell. that puts it into the Stone Age. And the other thing is that the tunnels underneath the Bosnian pyramids were completely decommissioned. They were filled up with rubble. And so it's taken them 8 years to dig through maybe 2 miles worth of them. And the entrance was found through a very powerful high-definition scanning technology. And sure enough, X marks the spot. This is the entrance. They went and they found the entrance. And so that's now known as space archaeology, where there is, you know, there are techniques that can go and penetrate into the ground some 3,200 meters.
A couple of questions here with the Bosnian pyramid, and that is to fill it up with rubble suggests that and to decommission the maybe energy generation of that pyramid implies that it was an energy generator, or you have to physically stop the energy generation by doing something like that. And also, was there any information on its particular alignment with constellations?
Actually, I haven't looked into that. It's got to align with something, because everything had a sky-ground correlation, but I haven't actually tried to figure that out myself, and I haven't heard anybody else either. But they found another pyramid in Serbia as well, and so they're dotted all over the place, and they're quite close to one another, and there are three pyramids there. There's the Pyramid of the Sun, and the Pyramid of the Moon, and the Pyramid of Love, I think they've called it. And so that would be something worth investigating. And Dr. Sam, you know, and I'm going to be speaking with him in Chicago at the Global Pyramid Conference, October 11th and 12th, just outside of Chicago. He does a talk where he talks about pyramids found all over the world, and the ones that are straight-sided have seven characteristics that make them energy generators, and one of them is the passageways underneath, and the second is that there's water down there, and that the energy comes off the top of the pyramid, the layers that they're built out of, and the alignment on the telluric currents and all of that. And so the energy inside those tunnels, inside the Bosnian pyramids, is just amazing, and they've measured up to 14,000 times the negative ions that you would have just outdoors right beside it. And they've also measured the energy coming off the top of the pyramid that seems to magnify the farther away you get. And so he suggests a connection off-planet, where it's transmitting and receiving, but there's also something transmitting and receiving somewhere else. And I mean, that's not being talked about at all. It's very, very powerful. And so he sent me a video 2 months ago or something, where he's having a conversation in the pyramids with Eric von Daniken. And here's the camera operator, and the two of them are just talking, and there's all these plasma beings flying around them. I think if you took a still shot, you'd think of them as orbs. But these things actually move around, and there were so many of them. And, of course, with the naked eye, you don't see them, and the cameraman likely didn't see them either, but the camera picked up on it. So it's just absolutely astonishing, astonishing. And they're finding all kinds of artifacts in the Bosnian pyramids as well. And so they're sifting all this rubble that they're pulling out. And, of course, it's very slow going because they have to reinforce the ceiling of the passageways, or else the whole thing was going to collapse. And they're finding unified writing all over the world, these strange symbols that almost look like runes, but they're not finding them just in one place. And one of the astonishing things about the finds at the Bosnian pyramids is it was a left-handed culture, which speaks to the idea of matriarchy. And so if you take some of these little stone goddess figures, if you will, and you put them in your right hand, they don't feel comfortable, but if you put them in your left hand, they do. And they also found a bare-bone flute, for lack of better words, that has little holes in it, and people tried to play it by holding it in their right hand, and it wouldn't play. And then somebody from the Philharmonic Orchestra, the Sarajevo Philharmonic Orchestra, decided to put it in his left hand and played it the other way, and I saw him do it. He got 4 octaves out of it. And so we're talking, you know, Stone Age, sophisticated, artistic, global pyramid culture way back 38,000 years ago?
Well, this ties into your series, The New Atlantis, and you had pointed out before that your idea of Atlantis is that it's not just in one spot, and it was all over the globe. Can you talk about that further?
Well, a lot of people just want X marks the spot, Atlantis was here, and it's proven the end. But, you know, there's the high Altiplano in South America, and some people say Atlantis was there. And then there's evidence of the Bimini Road and the Bermuda Triangle in the Atlantic Ocean, and it might have been there. And the tops of the mountains could have been the Azores Islands in the center of the Atlantic Ocean. And it could have been here, and it could have been there. Okay, so I say it was everywhere. I think that there's evidence, and Gavin Menzies has brought us some of this, of a worldwide seafaring culture that actually was able to desalinate water, salt water, on the boats, that was able to grow fruits and vegetables right on the boats, and that, you know, there's all kinds of legends, and we've relegated most of what's about Atlantis into a legendary, mythological framework, but there are ancient texts that that refer to this. Now, it also seems that the continent was struck by asteroids or who knows what that actually created earthquakes and tsunamis and all of that and broke part of it apart. And it could well be that the center, the main city, the capital of it was in the center of the Atlantic Ocean. But it also seems that that Atlantis had colonies all over the planet. And so there is a legend that says when the head of the crab hits the heart of the lion, which is suggesting that the constellation of Cancer and Leo somehow collide, and that's not possible if you're just thinking about orbits and all of that. But it's even in Egypt, it's shown that they went from a 360-day year calendar to 365. And so they had to recalibrate everything, and it seems that this is part of what the world flood was, that something hit the earth and knocked the axis off. And so I think that the Atlanteans actually had forward knowledge of this, and that's what that legend of the head of the crab and the heart of the lion, that there was some way to predict an asteroid hit, and that they would have made plans, and they had high sophisticated technology. Now, the other thing is Atlantis is so old that if you think about the 26,000-year precessional cycle,
right,
they had time to be in a golden age and a dark age and a golden age and a dark age. So Atlantis wasn't one place, wasn't one time, and even that culture would have changed. But they would have had a sense of self-preservation. And so there's a third-party hypothesis, and pyramid sites around the world talk about the ancestors and the knowledge they had, and it could have been that they all had Atlantean ancestors and that there were colonies around the earth and that they built pyramids. And part of it may have been to stabilize the telluric energies on the planet. And there's clues here and there, and that's what the New Atlantis is really looking at, is you know, making animations to show how this could have worked and evidence that shows similarities all around the planet, similar writing. And Klaus Dohna is onto that as well. Is that how is it that we're finding similar writing in Peru and in Bosnia and in South Africa and similar artifacts? I mean, you can't exactly walk from Bosnia to South Africa, and they're finding things like I saw with my own eyes. I went to do to shoot a trailer for Michael Tillinger in South Africa, and inside his museum, the stuff looks almost exactly like it does in the lab in Bosnia. I just about dropped when I saw that. So that means that there was some kind of unified worldwide culture.
I love it. And this is going to be in your new documentary series that you're producing, writing, and working on right now, titled The New Atlantis. There's some things that have happened recently that you can't go into right away, but we'll be able to divulge in a month or two. And this is very, very exciting, listeners, what's about to be revealed. But right now, trust that this is going to be a powerful, very interesting documentary series. It is being independently funded right now. And Dr. Bolter, can you remind listeners where they could find out more information and maybe if they could help fund this project, how they would do that?
PyramidCode.com. The information will lead you to an Indiegogo campaign. And I appreciate all the support that people have already offered in terms of being interested in the new series, and so hopefully they can participate in history in the making. Just to connect a few of those dots that you mentioned a moment ago, there's a new discipline, I suppose you can call it, called space archaeology. And, of course, things have to be grounded in the field as well. So you can have a hypothesis from a dream or even a past life recall, if you will. But then things have to be verified in some way. And so there have been people who have had access to high-definition satellite scans, and one of them said that they found a bunch of pyramids in Egypt, and but she had never been to Egypt, but look at all these pyramids, and you can find pyramids in Egypt without even going. But it turns out, if you've been on any expeditions in the open desert, that sand dunes take a pyramid shape. And it's really quite uncanny, but it's plain as day that they're not real buildings. You can see that they're sand. So that was somebody who didn't go to the field to verify that their findings added up. But there's another one, and her name's escaping me, but she's going to be at the Global Pyramid Conference, and she did a TED Talk. And they had done a satellite scan and found dwellings and roads underneath the sand in Egypt. And it did far infrared analysis of it, and then they went to Egypt, and to the exact X marks the spot, and they drilled down a 4-inch round hole and came up with pottery, beads, things that would indicate that human civilization could have been down there. And so whether they do a full excavation or not, they have verified that there's human occupation down right there. And so, you know, the hypothesis and the scan is one thing. And so this is, you know, not too many people can get their hands on those scans. But we have a connection, and we're finding very, very, very interesting places that have not been excavated yet. But this is the way that they found the entrance to the Bosnian pyramids and a number of other things that have then been verified in various countries around the world. And so it's very much looking like these scans are accurate. And it's similar to ground-penetrating radar, but in the past they would lay wires on top of the ground and then send a low electrical charge down, and then they could see if there were cavities. But it's like the difference between a 1-megapixel camera and a 1,000-megapixel camera. Like, you can see anomalies with these scans. You can see if there's gold, if there's bone, if there's pottery, if there's chambers, passageways, and this sort of thing. It's very exciting, and it's undeniable. Now, again, governments, mainstream media, you know, they seem to not want us to find out the true history of our origins or how old we are or what the ancients knew. But too bad. We're finding out anyway. And so we can only hope that there'll be some kind of cooperation and that, you know, the tide will shift and that we actually can go and do a formal excavation and find some of these things. But we still know it's there. And so that's what's really exciting. Whether they cooperate or not, we've actually found something. So it's pretty exciting.
It is exciting, and I can't think of anyone else who would be best suited to produce such a documentary and reveal this information to people in the world. Dr. Carmen Bolter, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again next Monday, 10 p.m.